You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you all for coming. This is an exciting time for us. This is an opportunity for us to take a look back at the first 2 years of the Online Media Legal Network and see how we've been doing. It's a chance for us to talk to you a little bit more about what we do and how we go about it. We're privileged to have David here with us today, and I'll be speaking with David a little bit about his experience in starting the network and what he was thinking when he got us all involved in this and why he did that and, sort of how we find ourselves where we are. We will go through a little bit about the process that the OMLN follows in attempting to place clients, how we vet clients who come to us for assistance, how we find them attorneys, and then how we follow through on that process. And we will also be talking about some of the results that we've seen, the kinds of matters we've seen, the development of our network, the kinds of attorneys who are in our network, and seeing how well we've been doing matching one to the other. And then finally, we're going to be talking a little bit about what we expect to be doing with the network in the future. It's a remarkable tool. It has any number of possible purposes, and so we want to think a little bit about what we're trying to do with those, with the network, with our clients, with the attorneys who are helping us out here. And I'm very glad to see that we have some of the attorneys in our network here in the room, and also our clients. We couldn't do this without you guys, so we're very pleased to have you here. So the first thing I'd like to do is talk to David a little bit and ask him some questions about what was going on in his mind when this all got started. Now, this comes from our website, and that's just a definition of the OMLN and what we do. We are a legal referral network. We have many different types of attorneys in the network. We provide pro bono and reduced fee legal assistance through the kind services of our attorney network, and we focus on journalism. But that's just a definition. David, can you tell me a little bit more about the background? What led you to start this?
Sure. So the idea for the network really came in 2006 when Phil Malone, Dan Gilmore, and I had a conversation about the monumental changes going on in journalism, primarily how the internet was changing journalism. And that those who were dealing with legal issues had nowhere to go to get help. And in fact, there was no one really focused on the legal needs of independent and small journalists. And so we set out back in 2006 to create the Citizen Media Law Project. It was really around sort of pulling together educational resources, letting folks have a website where they could go and read about copyright law and read about defamation law, and written in a way that would make sense to a non-lawyer. We were very fortunate that Dan Gilmore suggested, well, make a pitch to the Knight Foundation. They're starting this new thing called the Knight News Challenge, and they don't really know who they're going to fund, and you got a shot. And so we made a pitch, and we're very fortunate to win a grant in that first year before Knight really had an idea of how many people wanted their money and how tough it was going to be, and we got in at that early stage. And that got the project off the ground. So we were able to build a very comprehensive set of legal resources online to help folks answer their legal needs. But what we discovered was that education only went so far. Folks really needed a lawyer of their own to ask questions and to get help. And we were fortunate in that early time period that Phil, being the director of the Cyber Law Clinic, we had access to the best staffed, most knowledgeable law school clinic in the country to do this kind of work, but we were still getting more requests than we could handle. I was calling up lawyers that I knew from private practice and begging them on the phone to take this great client in San Francisco or whatever to provide them assistance, but it just wasn't going to keep up with the number of requests we were getting to have this be done informally, and so we started thinking, well, we need to build something, some structure behind this, some way of making it easy for lawyers who want to do work for these kinds of clients. And it was when I was in private practice in Washington D.C., I really wanted to do pro bono work, and the opportunities for pro bono work at that time were pretty much go down to the superior court and take on criminal cases. So I went down and litigated defendants in drug cases. It was great experience for a young lawyer, but it had nothing to do with the kind of legal work I was doing for paying clients, intellectual property, media law related type stuff. But there was just no way for me to find those kinds of clients. So I knew when I came up to Berkman Center that there was strong interest among lawyers to do this kind of work. It just wasn't easy for them to find those kinds of clients. And then we were seeing all these requests pouring in, coming in email, telephone, Carrie Anderson, who works the phone here at Berkman Center, can attest to, and Becca can as well, to the number of calls they get weekly from crazy people looking for legal assistance. Many of them are, you know, litigation about their cat, which is not the Berkman Center's expertise, although that is Becca's expertise. cats, that is. And so we thought that there was this strong desire among lawyers to work for these kinds of clients, a deep need for legal assistance, but what we lacked was a bridge to connect them. So the idea of building the network really came from those two communities that we thought we could provide help to.
And you mentioned the Cyber Law Clinic. I don't think it's possible to overstate the importance of the Cyber Law Clinic to the work that we do and the contributions that they make. So we're very grateful to have Phil and Chris in the room with us. But tell us a little bit more about how you took that idea and then turned it into a functioning network. Who did you turn to? How did you build that structure?
So the first thing we thought about with doing that is we realized we had to do this as efficiently as possible. That it could be very easy to get overwhelmed by the requests that came in. So we started thinking, Berkman Center is a fantastic place for leveraging technology to achieve things. And we started, so I pitched this idea to Dan Kalsperow, who's in the room with us. And it turns out Dan had done work, software development work for pro bono network of lawyers in Massachusetts. And Dan's enthusiasm was immediate and palpable, and he said, boy, I think that's a fantastic idea. I think we could build something to do it. And whenever I hear someone say, oh, I think I could do it, my mind says, oh, he's agreed to do it. Dan's going to do it. And we didn't really have a lot of money to do it, so we went to the Knight Foundation and cajoled and begged, and they initially thought, this is crazy, we're not going to throw any money at this, but eventually they conceded that it sounded like a good idea and gave us a little bit of money, and that's where we had this idea of creating a formal online media legal network. And so the idea was to try to make it as easy as possible. People have described it as a dating site for lawyers who want to find clients. And we let the lawyers, you're going to go through this and show it,
sure.
we try to make it as frictionless as possible for a lawyer who we know is busy, we know, you know, earns a lot of money billing their time to paying clients, that wants to find a pro bono client and can do that as easy as possible. And we saw technology as one of the ways to do it. The other thing we saw that was important that we offered is the Berkman Center's fingers into these communities of technologists, of journalists, of folks who are not in the mainstream of journalism organizations and don't really know that they have legal issues, and when you kind of educate them about their legal issues, they come at you with this huge list of things they never thought of that are absolutely have to be done by next Tuesday because that's when their site is launching. And that's why having the Cyber Law Clinic was actually so useful in the beginning, because we would go to Chris and beg him to take on a terms of service review, and does he have a student available who can do it over the weekend, and oftentimes he did. But it was, the idea was to, how could we create the most efficient mechanism for serving these clients, recognizing that we were going to be doing it on a shoestring. We were going to be doing it with the technology that we could build in-house.
And since you're mentioning funding, we should acknowledge our funders. I mean, in addition to support from Knight, we've received support from the Open Society Foundations, and we're very grateful for that, and a number of other funders, both foundation-based and private donors. And you know, it really is those donations and those funds which enable us to keep going. We're entirely foundation funded at this point, aside from a small number of private donations, and that allows us a degree of independence and freedom in what we do that's very important. And it also allows us to provide these services without charging our clients anything, or without charging the attorneys in the network to participate. So obviously, there are only so many clients that we can help.
Right.
And, you know, we do have client selection criteria on our website. These are the standards that we apply in terms of determining, you know, who we're actually going to bring into the network, who we're going to refer through the network. And we'll be talking about those a little bit more in a minute. But I just wanted to ask you, where did these come from?
Yeah, so as you'd expect, this was a long, drawn-out process to identify who it was we were interested in helping, because we knew we couldn't help everybody. We, with limited resources, we wanted to identify the kinds of clients we thought we could have the greatest impact. The initial idea behind this was actually floated at a Fellows Hour meeting 3 years ago or so, and we had a lot of smart people in the room who kind of said, well, think about this, think about that. And this was an effort to capture what is largely an intuitive decision. When and Arthur Bright, who handles many of these intake calls and did so last year when I was still running the project, you know, sometimes you want to help everybody. There's a very sympathetic folks who call you up. They're begging you for legal help. And sometimes you have to say no. And so we would turn to these kinds of things, primarily looking at whether their work was in the public interest. If they were doing something that we thought benefited their community or benefited a community in the nation or the world, that was good reason to help them. But I would say, and I'm sure you guys experience this now, that these are not bright lines, and there are often clients that come in on the margins. And then the question is, can we have an impact? And if the answer to that is yes, then generally speaking, we tend to let them in the network. But you do have to sometimes say no, and that's never easy.
And of course, we provide both pro bono and reduced fee assistance. Right. And I know that one of the issues that you encountered, and something that we still struggle with from time to time, is trying to explain to firms and attorneys in our network about why, you know, why some of these organizations should receive pro bono assistance. I mean, most law firms, especially big established law firms, tend to think of pro bono clients as being lower income people who are having issue possibly with a landlord-tenant issue, that kind of thing, as opposed to journalism. And so how did you go about trying to convince people that this was actually a good cause? I mean, we've got the pro bono criteria and we've got these numbers. I'd like to know where those came from.
Yeah,
but
so that was probably the most frustrating thing about starting this network, was swimming against the stream of how pro bono representation was envisioned, and still is largely by American Bar Association and therefore by many large law firms, which was really focused on indigent clients at a certain percentage below the poverty level, and that's obviously a hugely important community to provide legal services to, but that didn't fit our model. The folks who are looking to start an online website focused on their state house reporting is not likely to be below the indigency line. They may be a laid-off journalist, and they're feeling like they're below that poverty line, but they wouldn't fit the normal criteria. So we ended up having to have a lot of conversations with... We spoke to the head of the ABA's pro bono programs in Chicago, the American Bar Association, which sets these standards through a set of model rules that the states can then adopt. We spoke to the director of the Pro Bono Institute in New York, which is the leading organization for large firm pro bono practice, and we negotiated these numbers. We pushed for higher numbers. They pushed for lower numbers. We ended up setting the numbers, but then I don't think you have... Oh, so you do have this language here where for whom the payment of standard legal fees would significantly deplete the organization's resources. For us, that was the key phrase, because for many of our clients... that was the question we asked them. That was what we used to internally certify. And then it involves a negotiation with some of the law firms. Some law firms are more than willing to take on clients that are you know, a $500,000 budget, but are a nonprofit and they're meeting an important community need. Whereas another law firm might say, no, if their budget's over $100,000, we're not even going to talk to them. And it was a negotiation process. And it's, you know, it looks like a one size fits all approach because we sort of had to adopt something. But in the end, it ends up being a negotiation to try to find what works for the firm. And my hope is that, and I think that maybe we're starting to see this play out, is that a broad definition of a pro bono, which is that you can address the needs of underserved communities by supporting some of these non-traditional pro bono type project clients, and you'll have the same effect. But if you only focus very narrowly on clients who are below a certain financial threshold, you're going to exclude those kind of clients that can actually have quite a bit of impact on the communities you're desiring to serve.
And those clients include often for-profit organizations, smaller organizations, right, but nevertheless, which are meeting an important community need.
Absolutely. And you know, so part of that's also reflective of the upheaval going on in journalism today, which is there isn't really a clear business form that's going to be successful for journalism in the next decade. And so we wanted to be sure that what we weren't doing is creating a network that pushed folks into a certain type of business form, even though many of them do get pushed into being nonprofits. Tom Stites is working on a co-op business model that would hopefully be appealing to many journalism organizations. We wanted to be able to provide flexibility with the kinds of clients that came to us so that they could experiment with business forms and the lawyers would be willing to work with them still. And I should say, one thing that's helpful is that, and this is one of the things that Phil Malone and I have talked a lot about, is that the law school clinics don't tend to have as rigid a set of criteria for selecting clients. So we often turn to clinical programs, either here at the Cyber Law Clinic or at other clinics around the country, when we have a client that we think really needs help but isn't appealing to a law firm because of, for whatever financial reasons or other reasons. The clinics, fortunately, can be very helpful with that.
So obviously when the network was starting and you were getting ready to respond to these needs, you needed to have a collection of attorneys in the network before you could start to assign clients out. So what were your expectations in terms of the kinds of attorneys you wanted to pre-populate the network with? How did you find them?
Yeah, it's a good example to me in my life of how, you know, there's this old saying, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. That, you know, I came with my own biases, not even really knowing that I had them. I was a litigator, and I was primarily a media law litigator. So I went out and recruited media lawyers who do litigation and thought that was perfect, that was all we needed. And it turns out that most of our early clients, and in fact most of the clients who've come through the network, needed transactional assistance. They needed help with the kinds of things that I disdained as a lawyer, because I didn't have the expertise to do that. And we quickly realized that the sort of corpus of members that we had initially selected did not bring the expertise we needed exactly for the client needs. Now, in retrospect, it seems perfectly obvious that you know, almost every new business needs business assistance. Not every new business needs a lawyer to defend them in a piece of litigation, fortunately. And my view that everyone needs litigation assistance, you know, it doesn't make sense in retrospect. But at the time, that's what I thought.
And now we have a philosophy that we inherited from you that, you know, what we try to do is get out there and try to help clients before they see the cease and desist letter.
Right, right.
You know, try to make sure that, you know, their first encounter with the law isn't a lawsuit.
Right.
But so we're going to move forward into the future a little bit here. If we can go to the next slide. And it's hard to see on this one just because of the subtlety of the tones. But this is, it's a little bit easier on this one. This is our distribution of attorneys at the beginning of the network. The first states in which we had people, the concentrations, if you're having a little difficulty seeing the numbers here, the blue is 1 to 4 attorneys in a state, green is 5 to 10, yellow 11 to 25, there are no oranges on here, but you'll see them, 26 to 50, and then 51 plus. Now, so this is where we started. And David, I should say thank you. Please feel free to jump in as we go on here. Now, if we can roll forward in time, you'll see how the network has grown from its origin to the present. And so right now, we have attorneys in the network in 49 out of the 50 states, with the exception of South Carolina there, plus the District of Columbia.
If there's anybody watching from South Carolina that wants to sign up,
please, we're actively conducting outreach in South Carolina at this moment in order to try to fill that last gap. We actually have had a client from South Carolina who we were able to serve through an attorney elsewhere in the country, but that's a longer story. But starting from here, this is where we are now, and I'm going to turn it over to our staff attorney, Andy Sellers, to talk a little bit about what our process looks like right now and what clients can expect, what it looks like from our end, and what attorneys can expect when they work with the network.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. So before we get to the results, I already shut that off. So you can put it back. Before we go into the results, I want to explain a little bit about how the network works, how people find us, and what happens when they do find us. So clients come to us from a variety of different sources. One of the most exciting and interesting ways for us is that we do have several clients that come to us because they were already CMLP fans. They already use the CMLP legal guide, or they reviewed the database. They're familiar with the resources that we provided in the early years, and then transitioned over to the OMLN when they had a specific legal question that needed the assistance of an attorney.
So, and it's important to say, yes, and those tools that David described initially still exist. They're on the CMLP website at citmedialaw.org, and they remain a very important part of the services we provide.
Right. In addition to that, of course, we've talked a little bit about the funders for the CMLP and OMLN. Both Open Society and Knight have been wonderful resources for us to find new clients. Many of the Knight News Challenge winners will come to us shortly after they receive their grants to help get their business ventures or whatever their projects are, get them off the ground, get them launched. In addition, we've been able to tap into some journalism networks, principally the Investigative News Network and the Online News Association, both of which have been tremendous resources for us, and we hope we've been tremendous resources for them as well. Of course, Harvard has been very instrumental for us as well. Berkman Center has been a wonderful source of a lot of information and clients, as well as the Nieman folks who studied journalism more intensely. From the online world with Berkman and from the journalism world with Nieman, we've had a wonderful sort of source of a lot of interesting clients with a lot of interesting issues. Jeff and I also go out into the world and try and make ourselves available at a lot of different presentations and conferences across the country. We were very lucky to have the Online News Association's conference in Boston in the fall, and we were able to do a legal pre-conference here to touch on some of these issues. Jeff was down in Kennesaw, Georgia not too long ago for the Media Law and the Digital Age conference. I was at Block by Block. We've done an online education module, Pointer, and been to several other organizations, including Journalism That Matters, the American Educators in Journalism and Mass Communication Conference, and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists.
I should point out that Pointer is a relationship that David was responsible for developing and has been very useful, and it's an ongoing relationship.
And unsurprisingly, when we go to these conferences and we talk to people that are engaged in journalism out in the world, they come to us shortly thereafter with a lot of interesting legal questions. And I think every time we come back, we have a small roster of new clients that come to us with particular questions. And, of course, there are all the different organic ways that clients can find legal assistance out there. Of course, our favorite in the way that a number of clients are now coming to us is through good experiences with their friends. So a client comes in, they have a good experience, they tell their friends come to us. That's, of course, a wonderful way to grow the network. And, of course, a little bit of Google juice helps, too. We have people come to us after they do Google searches for legal help. Occasionally, you know, journalism legal help, but usually just legal help.
And a surprising number of people coming in after they search for, can I record my neighbor's telephone calls?
Yeah.
But, you know, there you go.
Actually, yeah, more than you would think.
I'm not kidding.
So
that used to be the number one most viewed page on our website.
It still
yeah.
is.
Yeah. So anyway, clients come to us from a variety of different ways, and the way we filter them all in is we have them fill out an intake form. This allows us to sort of establish some information about our relationship, what we're providing to them, and ask them a couple general questions about what they are doing in the journalism world and what they need legal assistance with. We then evaluate them under the same criteria we were discussing earlier. Obviously, not everyone that comes to us fits these criteria exactly. We've had about 400 independent requests for legal assistance come through, and that's generated about 170 clients for us so far. But we have a policy here that we don't like to leave anyone in the dark. We always like to point someone to a resource, even if it's not necessarily us.
And so, I mean, Andy's about to tell you about our filtering process and where they go, but it's important not to understate how much effort goes into, you know, winnowing through the clients, the potential clients that come to us for the ones we can help versus the ones that go other places. And we really do conduct detailed factual investigations as to what these people are doing and how they can best be helped. So
right.
Andy does a lot of that, and I know he's a little shy about telling you all about that, so I just wanted to mention
it. So every one of these requests usually starts some form of conversation. Sometimes it can be a long conversation, sometimes a short conversation, where we try and explore a little bit about what they're doing. And then we try and direct them to the right outlet. So for issues, for example, where they're simply a little undercooked, they have a general question about the law, but it's not in relation to a particular thing they're dealing with, or they just want to understand how a particular area of law works, we usually try and refer them to relevant legal sources on our legal guide, again, created and operated for several years now, as to be to give a background on critical issues of media law in a way that's written for educated non-lawyers. a lot of people have come to us not realizing that we focus primarily on journalism and media clients. So they'll have general legal questions, and we try and get them connected with organizations that can take their legal requests. We're very fortunate in this country to have legal referral organizations affiliated with, I think, every state bar association across the country, so we can always at least point them to there. There are also organizations that are dedicated to more arts-related issues, such as the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts and other organizations like that, that we're able to point clients to every once in a while. Finally, as Jeff and David indicated, though I don't know if we made it explicitly clear, our organization is conducting referrals in the United States. We deal with domestic lawyers dealing with United States issues of law. We do have clients that find us from outside of the United States and have legal questions that relate to situations that are arising in other countries.
We also have domestic clients who have issues which extend across borders.
Right. So for clients like that, we try and connect them with several organizations that we've developed relationships with, including the Lex Mundi Pro Bono Foundation, which operates around the world dealing with these issues, the Media Legal Defense Initiative, which is based in London and has a lot of clients or does a lot of work in Europe, and Media Defense Southeast Asia, as their title suggests, doing work in sort of Southeast Asia. But, of course, we have a lot of clients that do match our criteria, and we do take them in. The first step in the process is when it always begins with a phone call. We like to take some time, between half an hour, to talk to the client about their particular legal issue and explain what we can do for them. Some of the important things that we established very early on is that, you know, we are a referral network which relies on the time and attention and the expertise and geography of our lawyers. We don't always have the right lawyer with the expertise in the right area at the right time. And so we make clear that we cannot guarantee that we'll find them an attorney. We hope that think clients understand that. That's just a sort of an inherent constraint. I wish we could guarantee it. We simply can't. But we try and make that clear. We explain a little bit more about the referral process. On our end, we explain how our pro bono standards work and generally ask some probing questions about their particular issue. We help them think through some of their preliminary questions. Jeff has a great background in media law. I am developing skills in intellectual property. And so we both try and have our particular skill set that we try and apply in these areas to help match the client, help them understand their issue so they know what they're asking for from an attorney.
And because we both do have a legal background and are admitted attorneys, we're in a position where sometimes we can help the client shape the issue a little bit and phrase it in a manner which is more likely to attract the attention of one of the attorneys in our network. And Andy's right. I mean, it's very important to manage expectations in these calls because the last thing that you want is somebody counting on you for an urgent issue and only relying, only relying upon us as opposed to checking out all available resources for a potential referral. But what we like to say to the clients is that we will keep looking for an attorney for a client, either until we find one or until they tell us they no longer need us to look. And that's our guiding philosophy here. We never give up on a client without, there are very rare instances we'll talk about later where a client might disappear on us, in which case a matter might go temporarily dormant, but we never give up.
So after this intake call, we of course review financials. We have a financial questionnaire that they fill out with some documentation to back it up. And again, the standards you already heard about. After a matter has been qualified for pro bono or reduced fee aid, we create an anonymous description of the client and of the matter, and we put them up on the OMLN website. Now, most of the OMLN website happens behind the scenes. Most of the website is actually behind a password wall. The members of our network have a username and password, which we've generated for them, and they have indicated their where they are located, where they are licensed to practice, and the particular skills that they can bring, the particular areas of experience that they have, whether they handle transactional matters, litigation, what particular areas, be it intellectual property or defamation, business formation, things of that nature. Based on that information, we were able to tailor the website to exactly what they need. And I say we, of course. Dan and Anita deserve tremendous credit because all I'm describing right here is stuff that they built for us. But through the system that they built, we're able to tailor the website to their particular interests and needs. So when you log on to the website, you're able to see the best matches for the attorney, things in their particular geographic area that are dealing with areas of expertise which they've indicated. We also send an email out every other week to the attorneys. This is also custom generated. where we're able to highlight the particular areas of interest and geography. So if an attorney expresses interest in a matter, they then can review the information that we've provided. They read the anonymous description of the client and of the matter. If they're interested, they can actually request more information right on the page here at the green button on the right. We will then do an independent evaluation to make sure that we think the attorney is a good match for the client. I don't think we've ever said no because we like the attorneys that are in our network, but this is done primarily as a service for our clients to make sure that an attorney that has no business contacting them isn't contacting them.
Although it is true that sometimes more than one attorney will request to review a matter simultaneously. And we will evaluate the different attorneys which have expressed interest in a given matter and give it to the one we think is best. So there is a judgment call that comes in sometimes.
And that is our favorite problem to have, because that means we have a lot of attorney engagement, a lot of attorney interest, which is always good, because even if we can't connect the attorney with that particular matter, we usually can attract that attorney to a different matter in a related issue and then serve two clients, which is great. But assuming that we grant review, the attorney is then able to see the client's name and contact information. People outside the legal industry may not know, but before an attorney ever engages with a client, they always run a conflict of interest check with their firm or their organization to make sure that they have not represented a party that was against this particular party in a prior matter or is in another situation where they cannot represent the client for any reason. But assuming the conflicts check clears, they then contact the client. The attorney and the client then have a conversation to see if they feel comfortable working together. Clients are always the final say as to whether or not they feel comfortable engaging an attorney to help them with an issue. So we get that conversation going. We let them have that conversation. We generally step out of the picture, and then the attorney or client will get back to us saying, yep, we feel good, we're going to move forward with this, in which case we assign the matter to that attorney. Or they say, you know what, it's just not going to work out with this particular attorney. Can you find me another one? We'll then reopen the matter and put it back up to the network to see if anyone else is interested in taking on the matter. And again, very rarely does that second situation happen. Usually once the conversation starts, it follows its way to completion. So that's generally how it works in the back end. I'm going to flip it back over to Jeff to talk a little about what we've seen so far in the network as it's been operating for the past 2 years.
Sure. I'm going to stand up and walk around a little bit here because I like to point at things. Okay. So over the 2 years of the network, we've served, and you know, we took that group of 400 potential clients which came to us, ran through the vetting process, winnowed them down to 170 clients. Each client may have more than one of what we call matters. I mean, those are the discrete legal issues that we try to help them with. And out of the 170 clients, we've had 347 matters that have come into the network and which have been assigned to attorneys. Right now, our network stands at 231 attorneys in, as you saw earlier, 49 states plus the District of Columbia. Now, let's take a look first at the clients. This is the distribution of the issues that we've seen come through to us. Now, as David mentioned earlier when we were speaking, there was an expectation when we started that we would be seeing a lot of people coming in with questions about defamation, privacy, sort of traditional newsroom content issues. That's what we're calling non-IP content law here. You know, content issues that don't relate to intellectual property. As it turned out, that's only 12% of what we've seen come through, and there have been many more intellectual property questions coming through, clients coming through with, as David suggested, questions about how to form a business or how to handle certain kinds of transactional issues. One other definitional issue before we leave this slide, this category here, cyber law, is intended to capture legal issues which are sort of unique to online publishing. The way we think about it, that includes things like terms of use, privacy policies. It also includes computer crimes and certain kinds of internet-specific statutes. As it happens, everything that we've seen that falls within the cyber law category has turned out to be terms of use and privacy policies, and that's been the largest single topic we've seen come through. But again, if you take a look at the top 10 types of matters we've seen come through, nonprofit formation and counseling is huge. Then you hit a whole list of intellectual property issues and, you know, back to some business issues, and only then do you get down to this non-IP content law. Now, because the business issue was sort of a surprise, we wanted to break that out and take a look at exactly what was going on with that. It was sort of surprising. Many of our clients came to us already having an idea about what kind of business form they wanted to find, and they just wanted assistance actually establishing the corporation using a form which they had pre-selected. Only 12% of them came to us not sure about what they wanted to do. Now, and sometimes when somebody, and some of these include clients who came to us saying, well, I want to form a for-profit corporation, I want to form a nonprofit, and we talked to them for a while and they wouldn't be quite so sure. But again, most of them come in with this knowledge. And what's also surprising is that, at least to us, was that more than half of the people coming in wanted to form nonprofit journalism organizations. And the vast majority of those are looking for 501c3 tax-exempt status with the IRS. So that's been an aspect of the work that we've been trying to respond to when we've been trying to build our expertise. Okay. Now, just comparing litigation matters versus transactional matters. And again, this slide requires a little explanation just because it sort of understates the importance of litigation in terms of the work that we do. Keep in mind that that a client who comes to us looking for transactional assistance usually winds up with more than one transactional matter. They might come to us looking for assistance forming a business, looking for some assistance drafting contracts. All of those wind up being separate matters. And so if we were to do this in terms of clients as opposed to matters, this piece would be much larger. Chances are that this would represent more like 20 to 30% of the pie. But nevertheless, again, a focus, a lot more that nevertheless is going on with transactional matters than litigation. But litigation is also very much more important. It's an important need to be able to serve. A transactional matter, which a client doesn't get help on, may result in a loss to the company. A litigation matter that a client doesn't get help on could kill the company. And so, notwithstanding the fact that this may look like a small part of what we do, we feel it's a critical part of what we do. Okay, turning over to the attorney side now. This shows the areas in which our attorneys are claiming experience. Again, out of those 230 or so attorneys, the top four slots have intellectual property issues. Tied for fourth place, you get defamation and then privacy torts, and then some of the other matters that we handle and some of the business issues, some of the business formation questions. Another way of looking at the data from the OMLN attorneys, these are the percent of attorneys which are claiming experience in transactional matters, a little over 90%. Little over 80% are claiming experience handling media law litigation matters or IP litigation matters. Breaking out attorney experience by those buckets that we had talked about earlier, IP, non-IP, content law, business, cyber law, etc. Again, over 80% claim experience in intellectual property. This is all self-reporting, but we trust them. We actually do background checks on attorneys when they apply to join the network and try to make sure that they actually have some level of experience. It's worth noting that we do have some internal criteria about the attorneys who join us. We do look for experience in these particular types of matters. We also look for a certain number of years of experience. We welcome junior attorneys to join the network, but we like junior attorneys to be in a situation where they're being supervised by a more senior attorney. And that's, again, just to guarantee that once we refer a matter out to a client, that the attorney is in a position where they're able to serve the client correctly. So why don't we go on? And this is comparing the top 10 categories of client matter versus the number of attorneys we have serving those matters. And overall, we do very well. Even though they don't necessarily line up correctly in order, for most of them, we have plenty of attorneys in the network. They might not be geographically close, but they're at least topically available. The one exception is nonprofit formation and counseling, where we see 49 client matters, 23 attorneys. There are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, it was a little bit of a surprise about how many people we were going to need for this, and we are actively building our attorney base to handle those matters right now. The other issue is that we originally conceived of nonprofit formation and business formation, for-profit formation, as being the same type of matter. It rapidly became clear from talking to the attorneys in our network that they didn't see it that way. They saw nonprofit issues as being quite distinct from for-profit issues. as a result, we tried to go back through the attorneys in our network and figure out who had this kind of experience versus who had this kind of experience. Obviously, we could go back through matters which had already been handled and look at who was handling those matters and say, well, we know those attorneys can handle a nonprofit matter. However, there are likely to be quite a few more attorneys who are currently listed as for-profit formation specialists who have experience in nonprofit formation. So this number, the 23, is likely to be a little low, and it's just a matter of trying to, you know, back-populate our statistics so that they look correct on that issue. Another way to compare client need versus attorney coverage is this chart, which talks about percentage of matters in these same six clusters versus the attorneys claiming experience in those clusters. What we're hoping for here is that these lines will more or less track as you go along the top here. And pretty much we do fairly well. You know, more or less these are proportional. There is actually a 1 pixel wide blue line down here for the one criminal matter we handled. That was a criminal defamation matter early in the network. The one exception, obviously, is non-IP content law, which is a little disproportionate. And that's an interesting story. Partially, you know, as David was saying, we populated the network early on with those kinds of attorneys because we were expecting to see more of those kinds of clients. But this is also, I think, suggestive of a change in the nature of media law practices in the United States, which is that practitioners of media law are seeing their clients come to them with a lot more of these kind of questions, a lot more of the IP questions, a lot more of the business questions. And so there may not be as much demand for this expertise, but the attorneys who were serving that need previously are still around and they're still in our network. And so this may be disproportionately high. But again, this also may be a symptom of the online journalism industry not having reached a point where clients have moved beyond business formation and basic intellectual property issues to where they're actually starting to see some of the more complex content liability issues. This shows where our clients are coming from. Again, the same type of heat map we showed you earlier in terms of the attorneys, with concentrations coming out of California, New York, Massachusetts, more activity in the Pacific Northwest and in the Southeast. Now, we wanted to see whether the matters we were seeing were tracking U.S. population density, so we prepared this chart, which shows percentage of matters from a particular state versus the percentage of the U.S. population in that state. Places like California, Florida, North Carolina are roughly proportional, but you do get these odd spikes in Massachusetts and New York. It's not entirely clear right now whether this is tracking concentrations of activity in the tech sector and online publishing, or whether this is tracking awareness of our network in those locations. We're looking into that because obviously that will have an influence on how we promote the network and how we try to find new clients. Because if there are areas of the country, you know, Texas and Florida are places where we're seeing fewer clients than population density would suggest, it might be that we need to concentrate our outreach efforts in those areas. And then this is one of my favorite comparisons, which is the heat map of the matters we saw a moment ago with the current heat map of the attorneys, and just seeing how our coverage is matching up. And by and large, we're actually doing pretty well. The concentrations of attorneys are matching the concentrations of the clients in most states. That's by design. We do outreach to try to respond to what we're seeing coming from particular states. A couple of exceptions here are Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, where we have a slightly disproportionate concentration, you know, slightly lower concentration here than we do on the matters. But we've responded to this by actually, again, conducting affirmative outreach in those states. And since this chart was prepared, we actually picked up attorneys in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, so that one's a little bit out of date. Now, I'm going to turn it back over to Andy to talk about the experience of our clients in terms of how we've been able to serve them, just in terms of time to respond and some of the less quantifiable elements. But Andy,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we wanted to, since we had this data available, we wanted to spend a little bit of time also exploring, you know, we were very concerned about our coverage to make sure that we were matching the number of attorneys in the network with the matters that were coming in, make sure we had the right expertise and the right geography. We also want to make sure that the clients were having a good experience with us, because that's very important to the service we provide. So we were able to gather some data from the back end of our website for a cluster of about 160 matters out of the 347 that have come out, comparing when they came into the network to when they were assigned. We were expecting to see something of a bell curve here. We were expecting to see not a lot of stuff in the beginning, after a few weeks getting most of the matters out, and then a trail off at the end. We were surprised to learn when we actually started plugging in and chugging the data that a lot of stuff goes out very, very quickly compared to when it comes in within the first 2 weeks. We were a little surprised by this. I think a lot of this had to do with the fact that we think a lot more about the people that take longer to come out. There comes a point after about a few weeks in the network where we haven't had any attorney interest that we will go forth and do affirmative outreach. I'll start emailing attorneys in the network and say, hey, Dan, I've got a really good client in your area and your expertise that would be a really good fit for your practice. And Dan will say, cool, send them along, because Dan's great like that. Yeah, you're welcome. So that is the response to why we see the spike after about 6 or 7 weeks in the network. You see that second bump. The other hard thing to appreciate about this data is that we're comparing when they came in to when they were assigned. Assigned is ultimately a definition that the attorney sets for the relationship, and some people feel comfortable saying it's assigned when they're just having a conversation and it looks like things are moving forward. Some attorneys wait till they actually have a signed engagement letter in their hand before they mark a matter as assigned. Some might wait till there's actually an attorney in their firm that is working on the issue to mark it as assigned. So there is a degree of self-reporting which might skew the data a little bit in one way or the other. And as you'll see, most matters go out within the first 3 months that they come in, which is good because that's also what we tell the clients in the network to set their expectation. Some matters take longer. There are a variety of different reasons for that. Part of that is because we wait until it's assigned for the last time. So occasionally, very rarely, a matter will come in, will be assigned to an attorney. The attorney and the client will then work together for a while, and the client will come back to us and say, you know what, this is just not working out for us. Could you assign us with another attorney? We'll then reopen the matter, put it back through the network, connect them with another attorney. And on this chart, we don't take credit for that referral until they've found the attorney that they like. This is sort of like a matchmaking service in a lot of ways. It's they dated for a while, they realized it wasn't working, and we found them the love and marriage relationship. And there's a variety of other reasons, too. Some clients, because these are upstart ventures, some clients, these are on the back burner for them, and so they will put the project aside for a while working on other things and then pick up the project later and then want an attorney further down the road. So those are some of the reasons why stuff can take longer than a couple months to go out. We wanted to also share some sum totals about the client experience. We've had 347 matters be assigned, as we said earlier, as of the end of last week. We've also had 52 matters go inactive. There's a temptation to think of an inactive as a bad thing, but actually in most cases it's a very good thing. We mark a matter as inactive simply means that they don't need our assistance anymore. Sometimes that means they've resolved the issue already. Sometimes that means that we connected them with an attorney outside of our network because they were in a new geographic area or they're on an issue that we didn't have any particular coverage in, but we knew someone who would be a good fit. And then every once in a while, a client will vanish. We exercise great efforts to find a client that goes missing. I've emailed, called, found address, other phone numbers on Google and called them. I found one person on Facebook and sent them a Facebook message from my personal account being like, hey, where are you? So that's where we are. And as of right now, we have 10 matters that are open right now, variety of different legal topics across the country. We also have 14 matters which are currently under review. That's sort of a snapshot. This is fairly typical, maybe even a little bit light for the day-to-day of what the network looks like on any given day, at least this year.
And one thing we should say about some of those matters that go inactive, one of the things that we will also help a client evaluate is whether or not, although they don't know it, they might have insurance which will help them find an attorney with a particular issue. So, for example, some homeowners' policies actually provide coverage against defamation actions, believe it or not. A lot of people were surprised to find that they have that coverage, but once we point that out to them and they go read their policy and they call their insurer and they go, hey, wait, somebody's going to actually pay for an attorney for me. If there's an insurer willing to pay an attorney to handle the work, we want the attorneys to get paid. You know, we're not going to give them pro bono insurance if somebody is out there who can pay an attorney for their time and effort.
So that's the quantitative. We also want to take a second and review some quotes. I'm not going to read these to you, but just to share some of our clients and what they've said about the network. The Raleigh Public Record is a great example of a client of ours, a nonprofit based in Raleigh that's dedicated towards locally oriented journalism and educating new independent journalists out there. We connected them with Davis Wright Tremaine on a particular legal issue, and they were ecstatic about that. Up here in New England, we have the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. This is an initiative out of BU in their communication school that we've connected them with an attorney to help them with pre-publication review of content. If you're not familiar with this organization, they do these big, in-depth pieces on particular issues, especially in the New England area. I think the last one they did was related to ticket pricing strategies of the Boston Bruins. Very nice, in-depth piece of reporting that that we're very happy to connect them with an attorney to help them navigate some legal issues. The Common Language Project is another university-affiliated organization that does international and local journalism and journalism education at the University of Washington. We connected them with an attorney, and up in Denver, we have the Open Media Foundation, an organization that we helped them through their trademark registration process, in part with the wonderful help of the Cyber Law Clinic, and actually me when I was a student at the Cyber Law Clinic, which was kind of a nice touch. So that's sort of our experience and what's been going on so far. In the last few minutes that we have before we open up to questions, I want to turn back over to Jeff to talk a little bit about where we're going to go with this information we've gathered and the network in general.
Sure, and basically it's summed up right here: growth, research, and sharing. Growth. We are continuing to expand the network. We want to increase. We want to bring more clients in. We want to serve more clients. To do that, we need to bring more attorneys in. We try to respond again to depth of coverage issues, both geographically and in terms of topic areas. And we are continuing to look for more attorneys willing to do this kind of work. Research is sort of interesting. The OMLN Attorney Network is a tremendous resource of information and experience and data concerning all kinds of activity in the media law field. And we are looking for ways to try to tap that network, not only to respond to particular needs, but also to learn about things like trends in legal issues which are coming up, particular concerns we have or threats to freedom of expression and freedom of speech. A good example of that we've been looking at lately relates to journalism nonprofit organizations. One of our clients came to us a little bit earlier this year and said, hey, look, I've been stuck in this process at the IRS for over a year.
Almost 2 years, yeah.
Yeah. And, what's going on here? And we actually reached out to the network and said, hey, folks, what have you seen? Can you tell us about what your experiences have been in this regard? And we started getting back anecdotal evidence from various attorneys saying, yeah, we've had a client in process for 8 months. We've had a client in process for 12 months. We've had a client in process for 16 months. And we began to see a pattern and began to learn that the IRS was somehow treating journalism organizations differently than other organizations. We then went back to our network, to people with specific experience in dealing with the IRS and exempt organizations, talked to them, learned from them about how the IRS normally processes these kind of applications for tax exemptions, how this differed, and what it probably meant. We then took that information and are beginning to develop resources for people who are in the tax exemption process to help them navigate this process, respond to the concerns that the IRS has about these types of organizations, and hopefully help them to reach a more beneficial result, and hopefully, also to a certain extent encourage the IRS to move a little bit more quickly, because we'll be ideally providing them with applicants who are better able to respond to their concerns. So that's just one example of, something else that this network can do. And we're always thinking about other ways to use that network and, enable the attorneys in the network to work together to achieve some of these results. And the last element, sharing. The OMLN website itself and the back end that Dan and Anita designed was designed to be portable. It was designed to be modular. The ideal would be that we could actually take the OMLN website, package up the architecture, and share it for free with other organizations interested in running legal referral networks. And so they can have the architecture, our client management system, our attorney management system, and be able to use it to develop other networks to address other needs, or even some of the same needs we're doing. The more help we can get on this, the better. And that's a project that we very much want to continue forward with and try to expand so that we're not the only ones out here doing this. And that's about it. I'd like to thank you all for listening to us talk. We're happy to take questions. I would just like to thank particularly David, for joining us, coming up from North Carolina to talk to us today, and Dan and Anita for their help on the website, all of the attorneys in the room who are members of the network, all of the clients in the room who trusted us, our staff attorneys, Andy and Arthur, and, you know, our interns, wherever they are, hopefully you're watching, and all of the other people who make this happen, because although, you know, Andy and I and Arthur do this day to day, we couldn't do it without a huge number of people. So
yeah,
thank
you
very much.
I do want to say a quick thank you to Lauren Campbell and John Sharkey for posterity's sake, because they did a tremendous amount of work gathering the data and presenting it here. And they are both preparing and taking for finals right now, so they couldn't be here with us today. But I did want to thank them as well. So.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, thank you. So the other thing I will say before I take questions is that right about this time, cake should be being served in the other room. So if you feel like getting a piece, please feel free. But questions, yes.
Have you had many requests from the Occupy folks across the country?
We have not had requests coming in directly from people involved in the Occupy protests. Outside of the OMLN, the Citizen Media Law Project developed a set of resources for journalists and other organizations trying to cover the Occupy protests. So we developed a pocket legal guide for journalists who are covering the protests, tell them a little bit about what is legal and what's not legal for them to do when trying to record what's going on at those events.
Yeah, Josh Stearns at Free Press and us, we've been in conversations a little bit, especially a few months ago when we first realized that some journalists were getting arrested at the Occupy protests. We decided that it would be really helpful to create a guide as to a journalist's legal rights and responsibilities. We wrote it particularly tailored to the New York situation, to Zuccotti Park, and the laws and regulations in New York. But then we created a more neutral modular version of it and put it on
less,
the...
Less state-specific.
Less state-specific. Okay. And share that through an app with the First Amendment Coalition.
Yes. Yeah, so we have partnerships with a large number of journalism and media and First Amendment-related organizations throughout the country. And the First Amendment Coalition has a very nice mobile app that they were kind enough to allow us to share some space on. Any other questions?
No questions.
So just thinking about growth, do you have any sense, even kind of informal, anecdotal, of kind of what percentage of the need that's out there in some undefined way that you're actually hearing about in meeting and sort of at the tip of the iceberg, or are you getting a pretty good chunk of it? Do you have any sense of just how great it is and kind of where you're going to go based on that over the next year or two?
It is, very difficult to tell just because we only see the people who come to us. I mean, sometimes we'll identify cases that we'll actually reach out and say, oh, by the way, we saw you're having this issue. Do you need help? Just going by the amount of news coverage that we track addressing these issues, I'd say that there is a substantial unmet need. And so, it is important for us to keep spreading awareness of what we do. I don't think we're reaching everybody. I unfortunately can't say really more than that because that's a lot of hidden data. Yes.
In the future, do you expect, I mean, I know it's only been 2 years, but maybe in 5-10 years to kind of move internationally and not just refer, but also have international lawyers be in your network?
We are very interested in trying to do that. The question that we've been, there are a couple of different issues which come up when we think about that. First of all is our ethical obligations as United States attorneys in terms of referrals, in terms of figuring out who we're referring to. In the United States, it's relatively easy to do a background check on an attorney and figure out who they are. It's more difficult to do that internationally. There's also something of a disconnect still in terms of the types of issues which come up in different places in the world. Take our partners down in Media Defense Southeast Asia. They are still dealing on a routine basis with issues involving journalists being arrested or killed or imprisoned for extended periods of time. Those aren't issues, fortunately, which we often face in the United States. And so when you're trying to figure out how to expand into those areas, it's very important to understand the media landscape there and try, so there are some complexities there. But yes, I mean, either through strengthening our relationships with these networks so it becomes a more formal, network of networks, or by expanding directly, we do hope to strengthen those connections. Yeah.
I was wondering, when you're talking with clients, do you see any sort of tension, or do they ask questions that are sort of highlighting a difference between providing legal advice versus strategic business advice? Is that somebody coming to you with a specific legal problem versus somebody coming to you to sort of ask more broader general questions about how to position themselves or their set of issues? Because it seems like there's actually, you're probably developing a real sense of competency of the field of sort of these edge cases or problematic moments, and it seems like a different kind of advice.
I think every conversation inherently has some business to it. I think that that a lot of times when clients are coming to us, this is the first time they've had a real conversation with a professional of any stripe about their business model, about what they're trying to do. They think of legal first for whatever reason. Some that's not the case, but some that certainly is the case. And so, yeah, I think that as part of our consultation, we try and ask the questions, sort of say, oh, so I see you're interested in becoming a nonprofit. Where do you plan to get your funding? Or I see that you're planning to operate as a for-profit. Where do you plan to get your revenue? And you know, ask some questions like that. Typically, it seems that clients have thought about this to some extent already, but they do like to share because they like to see if they're doing a gut check. And very often when people come asking for legal advice, a lot of the advice they're actually seeking is, am I crazy? Could this work?
Right. I mean, and strategy is an essential element of providing effective legal advice. I mean, you can't give them the right advice without understanding what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And tailoring the advice to the strategy.
It would be a disservice if we didn't get the full picture.
Do you make suggestions more about strategy?
Sometimes.
Providing,
yeah, I mean, generally, you know, our goal is to enable the client to do what they want to do. And so we try not to give advice which shifts them away from what they're attempting to do. We might make suggestions as to how better to go about it. And go ahead.
Along those lines, Mike, you raise a good point, which was initially when I envisioned the network and pitched it to the Knight Foundation, I pitched it to them almost like a legal consultant, that the idea would be to match the client with a lawyer who could be with them long term, could understand their business and their objectives in such a way that they could provide more than just pure legal counsel. And it's actually, we're seeing the lawyer's role evolve. Law schools are catching up to that. I mean, David leads a winter term problem solving initiative that the law school has implemented 2 years ago, which is an effort to teach students how to solve problems, which is really what a lawyer's role is. And I felt when I worked as a litigator at a firm, I was only seeing part of what a lawyer did. I really saw the bigger picture when I went in-house at a newspaper, and I realized that my internal clients were coming to me with questions about problems. The law may be one small slice of that problem, but it was just a small slice, and unless I understood the whole range of their concern, I wasn't going to be an effective counselor to them. And that's a very hard thing to teach law students in traditional doctrinal classes to do that. It's also very hard skill to develop even when you're in practice as a lawyer, but it's a thing that separates the sort of good lawyers from the great lawyers, from the lawyers that establish a relationship with a client that lasts a lifetime. It's because that lawyer is a trusted advisor on a range of issues. And I think our hope was, my hope in the network, creating the network initially, was that to establish those relationships with great lawyers so that that kind of full range of counseling, strategic, legal, economic, whatever, could be part of the conversation. So.
Yeah, and there's just add one last twist to that. I mean, it is tricky in a network like this to find an attorney who's willing to commit to a long-term relationship with a client they've never met. You know, it's much easier to get an assignment of a short-term matter, develop a relationship, and then sometimes clients will come back with successive matters. Often when a client comes to us for transactional work, we will try to break out their different needs and try to sequence them so they're not trying to solve five problems simultaneously, but try to solve the first problem and then, you know, try to do them in a rational order. Often the same lawyer will come back and take those later matters, and that's where the relationship starts to develop.
Yeah, one of the favorite stories we get to see from the data is an attorney that takes one matter, a couple weeks go by, and then the attorney takes all of their other remaining matters, because that indicates to us that they've developed a more permanent relationship, which is a wonderful thing. Herbert, you had a question?
Yeah, along these lines, do you contemplate on a feedback on a more systematic level to legal education and legal research, both in terms of process, procedures, organization, institution you have developed, as with regard to the qualitative questions of legal issues facing the new media landscape?
I would be fascinated to try to do, you know, more formal research into these areas and try to get some harder results than what we're seeing here. The nature of the self-reporting makes that a challenge. In terms of the clients who come to us are obviously the ones who are aware they need help. We do have an impact on how their matters are phrased, and so to a certain extent the types of matters can be guided by us internally. There are all kinds of biases here. The other drawback is that Andy and I are both practicing attorneys. We're not researchers, and so we don't have that expertise. We have reached out to people within Berkman to try to address some of those issues and try to learn a little bit more about how to go about that. But it is an area that we're very, very interested in.
And I began to see this before I left, especially this idea that IP-related issues were becoming much more prevalent in media law practice. When I was a media lawyer, shortly out of law school, we didn't do any IP work at all. It was really strictly the news gathering and publication torts. That's not media law practice anymore. So I've actually proposed a new class at University of North Carolina, which is meant to bring in many more IP issues into a class, tentatively calling it a media law practicum, for third-year students who have already taken a media law class and an IP survey class, want to roll up their sleeves in a sort of transition to practice environment, and that covers many of these IP-related issues, because that's really central to many of their clients' legal needs. In legal education, we need to either train lawyers or they need to get the on-the-job training to do that, and it becomes very hard for law firms to be willing to spend the money on a young associate to train them to do these things. It's better if the law schools can prepare them better to handle those kinds of a range of client needs. So at least, you know, my effort is to push that at law schools. I hope more law schools do that.
I was just going to quickly think about that to say, I think maybe journalism schools might benefit from the inverse as well, so not just thinking about law schools learning from your experience, but also journalism schools.
David has some interesting projects he's working on in exactly this field, which hopefully we'll be able to report on the next time.
I think there's a great benefit for students who are interested in this area, and many students come into law school with an interest in technology, to begin to recognize that almost every business entity has media law issues. They may be a maker of spark plugs, but they've got folks who are using social media to get the word out about their fantastic new spark plugs. And so they've got media law issues. They've got internal publications, external publications. And so to sort of just cabin off media clients in this realm over there is to really ignore how these issues play out across a range of different business types. And I think that means communicating folks in the strategic communications departments at communication schools, attaching them to the legal issues, to really look at this not in the sort of normal stovepipes that many academic institutions are set up, but to see across doctrines, to see across disciplines that way.
Okay. And we've got time for maybe one more quick question, if anybody. Or cake. Okay.
Well, cake.
Cake it is.
Thank you so much.